job at the University of Tennessee and have had the fortune to work with a team of experts in this arena. So I'd also like to thank Dr. Pamela Connor, Dr. Ernestine Small, Dr. Margaret Hartig, Dr. Carol Warren Blakemore, and Herm Chang, who is my statistician. Those who are not familiar with drug courts really don't understand what's happening in the judicial system that actually, a few years ago, created legislation. The whole purpose of the drug courts are to coordinate efforts between the judiciary, prosecution, defense, and probation, law enforcement, social services, and mental health and their treatment communities. It was birthed as an option to incarceration, and when you look at the amount of money we spend on incarceration, you'll understand why this population-focused intervention is actually working. What happens is there's quick identification of the criminal who is addicted, and consequently, they are enrolled in the drug court program where they go into treatment. They have community supervision, and it's an effective long-term treatment because rearrest means that all bets are off and you go to jail. The first one was in Miami, Florida. There are over 2,000 of these types of programs today, and what the Government Affairs Office has reported is that it is a substantial reduction in crime by lowering the rearrest and conviction rates among drug court graduates. There are 45 drug courts in 53 counties in Tennessee. Shelby County Drug Court began in 1997, and it's one of 33 mentor courts nationally. So far, they've graduated over 849 persons, and the recidivism rate in our county is about 30%. That's compared to about 80% of other incarcerated individuals who go to jail and then are released without addictive treatment or addiction treatment. It was established that we didn't have enough services, so the Drug Court Foundation was established in 2004. It's a not-for-profit, and the idea was to raise money for the services that were gaps within the drug court services. The Drug Court Treatment Act was passed in 2003, and money started to filter in the states for the expansion of these types of programs. I have listed in the PowerPoints the 10 key concepts. However, I'm not going to spend time going over them, but they're certainly available to you. And here they are. And look at the access to treatment and rehabilitation as part of a key concept for population intervention. We need to be able to gauge the effectiveness of these programs, so one of the big pushes is to make sure we have outcome data. Another one that fits real nicely with public health nursing is the forging partnerships among the different agencies. So the Office of Justice Programs in Tennessee awarded a grant to the foundation. The foundation then contracted with the University of Tennessee to provide health assessments. To my knowledge, and after a significant lit review, there's never been this type of assessment of drug court clients. And as a consequence, there's no literature about it. So, what we wanted to do was evaluate the health and lifestyle risk factors and report on these outcomes to the judge, because the judge was essentially paying for it. We went through the IRB and got approval as an exempt study. And it was exempt because it was a little niche that says when you do examinations or any kind of health care specifically for a report for an entity, that it's a routine and that it's exempt from IRB. The assumptions that we made were drug court clients are users, sellers, and abusers or addicts. That was an assumption we kind of blew out too. Criminals, because they're arrested and convicted for a crime that are associated with drug use or sale. Sometimes they just got caught in a web, and they weren't users or abusers or selling, but they were around people who were doing it. We had another assumption that program enrollment would result in completion, and that some were going to accept the program just to avoid the jail. And many would successfully complete the program. Some won't. We don't really know why they relapse, but we think we do. But the literature is only comparative to the populations in jails. We also thought that they would adhere to a protocol while in treatment. And what we found was is that they were unpredictable with their appointments. And their failure to show up because it was a court-ordered evaluation was they went to jail if they didn't show up. We also thought they'd trust us because, by golly, we're public health nurses. We're trustworthy, okay? We were beneficent, and we had goals for the clients. We thought they'd understand them. In reality, they were very fearful of us and suspicious, and it resulted in some noncompliance where parts of the evaluation were declined selectively. For instance, we asked for urine to do a urine dipstick. They thought we were going to test for drugs. And we didn't test for drugs, but we had to explain to them that the reason they're giving us urine was for indices that would tell us about their systems functioning and not looking for the drugs. The court looks for the drugs. We were not looking for the drugs. It was a three-pronged approach. We assessed lifestyle risks, health history, and we did a physical evaluation that was complete, vision, hearing, neurological screening tests, mood, anger, violence, screening tools, laboratory tests that included screening all major body systems. And it was a naturalistic study of drug court clients, a convenience sample, if you will. And we used three treatment centers in the community. All had transitional housing centers associated with them. And in the sample, all phases of recovery were represented. There were 45 that eventually participated. 42% were female, 58% were male. One of the outcomes was that the court was afraid that they were biased toward male and against female, so this demonstrated that we actually had almost equal number of voting. They self-identified their race and culture, and when they did, 62% were African American, 36% were Caucasian, and 2% were Asian. Their ages broke down into two groups, the ones that I consider the younger and the older, and 44% were under 30, and 56% were over 30 or above. We looked at their health history, exposure to risk, their mental health, and their current physical health status. And we saw them anywhere from 1 week on arrest all the way up to 6 months after their arrest. We used descriptive statistics, we used McNamara's test, and we used linear regression. And this is our results. We found that 85% of them gained weight after enrollment, which if you look at what happens in addiction, that would make sense. 82% were smokers, so that's another addiction that we have to address as healthcare providers. Huge burden of disease, 73% had dental disease. Extreme disease, I'm not talking about one cavity or one bleeding area in the gingiva, this is entire mouths where the teeth are broken off and infected around the gums. Hypercholesterolemia, 54%, ear pathology in over 50%, either deafness or infection or just irritation from the smoke. They had genitourinary diseases. They had hepatitis C primarily, 39%. Huge numbers, I think, even as high as some of the incarcerated populations. 33% had detectable cardiovascular pathology. 32% had respiratory disease. And 17% were walking around with STIs and didn't know it. 17% had liver disease that resulted in referrals immediately for health care. 54% had evidence of mental health disease after our screening tools identified everything from depression to bipolar disorder to schizophrenia. and this was a number that I thought was significant, 25% had experienced deadly intrafamilial violence of a first-degree relative, which says we don't have any intervention for those who survive these experiences. These people also reported no health care in 5 or more years. 32%. Together, 22 and 32 makes 54% were not going to health care provider. It was so startling to us that they were not using the system that we coined this group of people a never-served population. And the definition is they're flying under the radar even of the underserved. Even so, you'd think that they'd go after government assistance in their recovery. We found that's not true. Only 8% had gone after government assistance. When we put the numbers to the crunchers, the number crunchers, we found that they ignored much of their dental disease. They didn't complain of their mouths hurting. They didn't complain of the illnesses that were associated with it at all. On the other hand, what we found was that if they had were smokers, that they knew if they couldn't breathe. So they were complaining of the upper respiratory symptoms and the difficulty breathing. What we found, too, was that different kinds of drugs are significantly related to race, those use of those drugs. And again, a myth is busted. White males use more types of drugs than all other groups. And one young man told me, I use a different drug every 2 weeks or so I won't get addicted. Conclusions. We recognize that the disease burden in this population is significant, and it's lethal. The diseases that we found are going to kill them, and it's going to kill them long before they should die. The need for health care for the never served has been what this study has revealed, and we have been working very hard in our community to make sure that we can get them into some type of system. What we found is they still don't show up for their appointments, they don't have health-seeking behaviors, they have poor coping skills, and they have no resources outside of what they had on the street. Thank you very much.